Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper, and welcome to this episode of the We Are Women podcast. Today, I have Natalie Stockdale. And Natalie's life has stretched from being an outback teacher, governess, and grazier on sheep and cattle stations around Longreach, which is in Queensland, to sailing with whales and dolphins in her ecotourism business and international work as a humane educator, promoting kindness to all life on earth. That is such a widespread and something we're definitely going to delve into, Natalie. In 2009, however, Natalie's world fell apart through divorce. 18 months later, she contracted cancer. And after surviving cancer and eventually waking up to the importance of resilience for our mind and body, she resigned from a job as the CEO of the Jane Goodall Institute Australia, dived into the study of mind-body medicine and stress management. On a mission to make happier, resilient people, Natalie is now a resilience coach for individuals, organisations and communities. Welcome, Natalie. That's such a diverse background.
Thank you, Janine. Yes, my life hasn't been dull. I don't think we were born to have a dull life either.
No, absolutely. No, something I've always wanted on my gravestone was she never missed out on a thing. But yeah. You know, looking at what you've got done here, there's certainly an extensive range of different activities that would have all brought different components to your life, you know, from the station living, which is something that most people would think, well, that would be nice, but it's very different when you're doing it. I'm actually reading a book about a governess in Longreach at the moment, which is interesting. Right. But then to, you know, be working with the Jane Goodall Institute in Australia, that's quite a diverse. So what is it about you that motivated and inspired you to do the country life and then into what you were doing, protecting the world and protecting animals?
Okay. Well, I grew up in the country, but in country in New South Wales and Victoria. And then my parents, when I was 11, put me into boarding school in Melbourne, which I really hated, to be honest. I was so homesick and I felt like it was prison. So my association with city, Melbourne in particular, cities, and boarding school is my association. It did have a big influence on me in terms of wanting to get out and have freedom. And so when boarding school years were over, my father insisted that I studied. So I thought if I become a teacher, then that way I could live in the bush or in the country. I can live anywhere I choose. So I studied teaching. I became a teacher. And as soon as I graduated, I've raced as far as I could away from the city.
That's a long way. Longreach is a long way from.
Well, yeah. Actually, went further. I went to the Northern Territory and I was teaching Aboriginal kids in the Northern Territory for a year. And then after that year, I moved then to Longreach as a governess. And yeah, I loved the freedom and the bush. I've always been attracted to nature and animals. So the animals has always been a thread throughout my life. That's probably been my one consistent. But yeah, I think from the boarding school years, I just had this hell-bent desire for freedom and the bush. So that's what really took me to Longreach and Western Queensland. And it was there that I was teaching at School of the Air, a governess in then teaching at School of the Air, married. And then my husband and I were, at the time, when I first married, were living in a little cottage, very safe, very content life. Only about 20 minutes on the outskirts of Long Reach, 20 minutes out of Long Reach on the bitumen road. So it was
very, which is not very far walking those country towns. You know, I know that used to drive from Long Reach to Winton to take their children, not Winton, to Mount Isa to take their son for a tennis game.
Right.
It's 20 minutes is nothing, isn't it?
No, it's nothing. Yeah. And my husband at the time was an overseer and I was a teacher at school there. So we both sought more adventure and another challenge. So at the time, it was 1991, and the drought just started taking hold of the region, and the land prices crashed, and the wool prices crashed. So it was we saw that as an opportunity to buy our own place. So with a great big debt, we bought our own rundown sheep and cattle station, and thought this is going to be. We weren't totally stupid, but we knew it was going to be challenging, but we didn't know just how difficult it was going to be. We thought, it's going to rain soon and the wool prices will pick up. Well, neither happened. It didn't rain for about another three years.
Yeah, it was after, long drought.
After we bought it, and the drought was already well and truly underway then when we did buy it. So my husband spent a lot of time working off the station, off station income, and I was teaching part-time at school of the air at this stage, but also it was my job to look after the station, which was 60,000 acres, and it was 120 kilometres from town. And we had at our peak, we had 7,000 sheep there. But as the drought continued, it was so heartbreaking. Yeah. We lost thousands of sheep. And my job was to daily pick to drive around all the dams and pull out the bogged sheep that were. And some of them were dead in the dam, and some of them had their eyes picked out by the crows. So I had to pull them out and then shoot them. I would shoot them and then drag them onto a pile of corpses. So I did that for years, and it was a lot of solitude as well because my husband being away a lot.
Yeah.
But I did have some resilience tools then, unconsciously. I didn't know anything about resilience then.
I think people who live on the land naturally build that resilience, don't they? Yeah. Because there's so much adversity coming at them.
Yes, there is. I can recognise now what my resilience tools were. And firstly, I had a good, healthy foundation. I used to exercise every day and eat good foods. And also I was grateful. I was so grateful, even though they were so hard sometimes. Sometimes were so, so heartbreaking. Mm. But I was always grateful that I had my husband and I had friends and wonderful neighbours, and I was living in the bush and nature. So gratitude was a big factor that helped me to cope. And I, when I did have company, like, for example, we'd go to our waterhole, which became increasingly diminished in size, but we'd go to a waterhole for picnics, sometimes with neighbours, and we would savour those times. And again, I suppose it's a form of gratitude, savouring times and moments and letting them, storing them until the next time. And
just on that point, I think that, and I don't want to keep interrupting your story because it's so fascinating, but there's so many points that you're bringing up. That savoring of moments is something that we forget to do, isn't it? There's simple little things that you just, you can sit and watch the beach or watch the water, yes, or something that you can just really appreciate it and savor that opportunity.
Absolutely. Jumping ahead a long way in, I write books about resilient people. And one of the people in the first book, Diane Moosa from Sydney, is legally blind and in constant physical pain. And she lives in an apartment in Sydney. And I wonder, how do you find joy and peace and happiness? And savouring is one of her tools for resilience. She said she even savours her cup of tea, or if she goes to the beach, she just savours the gentle breeze on her face. Mm-hmm. Just being really mindful of those precious moments is helpful.
Yeah. So how did you get from the land to the water with the whales? And that's
Well, my husband at the time, after years, was spent all my 20s and 30s in the bush, and then my husband had enough of grazing. So we thought, what are we going to do? We both had very open minds to do anything, and we wanted to actually make a difference. We wanted to make a positive difference in the world. That was important, but we also wanted to follow our hearts. So what we decided to do, because we didn't know what to do, we thought, let's treat ourselves to our individual dream holidays that might give us some inspiration. So I went to the Bahamas to swim with dolphins. It was the first, and when I arrived at the Bahamas, I was there at the same time as a Hurricane Rita. So I couldn't actually swim with the dolphins, but it was the very first time I'd been on a yacht, the very first time I'd sailed. And I remember sailing with the dolphins, and I thought, this is magic. This is absolute magic. And their little, the babies would turn on their sides and show their little pink bellies and have eye contact. I thought, gosh, life can't get any better. And from that moment, I realized how much I absolutely love the ocean and marine animals. So when we came back and we reunited, my husband had a business idea, and I said, well, I'd love to buy a yacht and run a sailing charter business, taking people out with whales and dolphins. So we did that. We moved down to the far south coast of New South Wales and had lived on a lovely, much, much smaller property. We brought our horses, stock horses from Queensland down, and I had my sailing charter business there for a couple of years, which was wonderful.
Right. Oh, nice. Yeah, that would be a hard day in the workplace, I imagine.
Yes, tough. Yes. No, it was actually wonderful. I remember the most thrilling part of it was to see the joy in other people, in the guests or the passengers that we would take out. And one man celebrated his 60th birthday, and he chartered the yacht as a private charter and celebrate his 60th birthday. And he was very well traveled. He'd been all around the world, and it was a fantastic day, and the whales were breaching all around us all day. It was fantastic. And at the end of the day, he said, that was the best day of my life. He said, I've been everywhere, and it was even better than the pyramids of Egypt.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. But connection with whales and dolphins in particular, you know, that there seems to be so much more to it than just looking at animals, isn't there?
Yes, there's that connection with wildlife is extremely therapeutic. There's loads and loads of evidence now that support the benefit, in fact, the importance of being in nature and being connected with nature.
Yeah.
Biophilia is our innate connection with nature, and when we're disconnected from it, actually that can make us stressed and sick. So yeah. Being immersed in nature is essential to our well-being.
Yes, I wouldn't have liked to have been in some of those city buildings when they were locked down for 3 years or longer, that you're just in a building or in a room.
It can't
definitely yeah. and that's part of that, you know, talking about the resilience that you talk about, that would be hard to, you know, come back from that, using having the tools possibly to do it, but surviving emotionally and mentally.
Yes. Oh, it must be so harmful to people's well-being, those long-term lockdowns.
Yeah. Now, I just have, before we go on to the resilience thing a bit more, the CEO of the Jane Goodall Institute, Australia, so that's quite a different step as well. Yes. And the cancer following that with the stress.
Yes, actually the cancer was before my work with Jane Goodall. So back on the south coast with my sailing charter business, I had two really happy years. When I look back on those years, they were really precious times. In fact, the home that we were living on, one of my girlfriends called it Happy Valley, because we were happy on this lovely idyllic property. My business was going well, and I had lots of animals. I had three daughters. I have three happy, healthy daughters, and lots of animals. You know, I had my horses from Queensland and dogs and two pigs that I adopted from Paramount Films. They played Wilbur in Charlotte's Web, the two pet pigs. So life was blissful for a couple of years, but it didn't last. My marriage suddenly came to an end, and I was suddenly replaced by another woman. So that I actually can identify three of my major life challenges, and they all happened to start with D. So the first one was drought. Second one was divorce. So I had to close. Subsequently, I had to close the business, you know, sell the yacht, and sell our home. And when you are now, I realize that when you're highly stressed, your decision making is impaired. So at the time, I thought, my husband wasn't working and I needed to support three daughters. And so I thought at the time, I should go down to Melbourne, which, you know, the city, go down to Melbourne and work in Melbourne and start again. And at that stage, I had a degree in animal welfare through Monash. And so I applied for a job as an animal welfare educator and down in Melbourne and got the job. So I moved down to Melbourne. My girls didn't want to come with me. So that was harrowing, absolutely harrowing, driving away and seeing my girls in the rear vision mirror, huddling together and crying. And I promised them that it would be temporary and one day we'll be back together again.
That would have been so difficult for you to do.
It was, and at the time I thought it was the best thing only to provide for my girls. But I regret it now. It was, in hindsight, it was a mistake, but at the time it was the best that I, you know, it was the best decision for me at the time. So I went down to Melbourne and 18 months later I became sick with cancer. And I now know, when I had the cancer, the oncologists would say to me, oh, it's just bad luck, it's just random, just like being struck by lightning. But I thought, I bet there's more to the story. And I not luckily, because of the brilliant surgeons, I survived my cancer, recovered. And it was at that stage, after that, that I applied for a job with the Jane Goodall Institute. So then I ran the Jane Goodall Institute Australia. But while it was a dream job, it was a wonderful job. But I kept wondering, you know, why did I become so sick? Because cancer wasn't in my breast cancer was not in my family history, and I'd always been healthy up until then. So I thought, why? And then I started joining the dots between stress and disease, and also between resilience and stress. And I realized that resilience is the antidote to stress, or is an antidote to stress.
Okay.
So I resigned from my job, and then I dived into the study of mind-body medicine and stress management therapies, and learned that indeed prolonged stress is so harmful to us, because when we hang on, some stress is actually good for us. It gets us up out of bed and motivates us. Mm-hmm. But it's when we hang on to toxic emotions, that is what causes harm to our mind and our body. It compromises our immune system and then opens the doorway to disease, which is what happened to me. So I actually became a recipe for a disease. I was living, I wasn't being authentic. I wasn't living authentically. Being down in the city, I didn't have anything I wasn't living in the way that were my values, that reflected my values.
And that's unfortunately what a lot of people end up doing, and that then contracting, having dis-ease in the body, and then contracting disease. And particularly from, you know, just my beliefs and an understanding of breast cancer, it's that nurturing to self, and that we don't do. And when we don't, then that tends to be how it represents, as that female nurturing as a breast cancer.
Yes, I've identified 25 tools that for resilience, and self-care that you referred to just now is absolutely fundamental to and self-love and genuine self-care is important.
Yeah. And that's, we get so busy with everything, don't we, that we tend to put ourselves last.
Yep. We treat everyone else, people around us, our loved ones well, but we often neglect ourselves. So it's really important to care for ourselves like we would care for people we love.
And it's not just the looking after yourself, you know, as an outside thing. It's how you speak to yourself.
Oh, well, absolutely. It certainly is. I call it mastering our thoughts is one of my 25 keys to resilience. The way you draw, it's very important to draw attention to the way you speak to yourself and to speak to yourself as you would speak to a person you actually love.
Oh, most definitely. And there's simple things, and I hear people, and I depending on who it is, but I pull people up now. And I've done that for quite a few years when I hear them just say something that goes, oh, that was just so silly, or little things like that. But they all add up and they all
count. Yes. Oh, yeah, I'm guilty of it myself still. I pull myself up sometimes and deliberately change my language. Like, for example, if I look in the mirror in the morning and sometimes my instant thoughts are, something really negative.
There's something about my bathroom mirror that it hides faults. I don't know whether it's
wonderful.
It is, but then you get a photo and you go, really? Sorry, what other time? It's quite funny. I have to look back in the mirror and go, there's obviously something on there. It's like being on Zoom with the filter.
Yes, they would.
And it's not a bad problem when we are looking in, when you're looking in the mirror and seeing yourself and not just making that judgment call, because that's the thing that as we get older, we tend to be more critical, but getting older is much better than the alternative.
Yes. But being kind to ourselves, kind and loving to ourselves is highly important for resilience.
Yes. Yeah.
Not blaming yourself and letting go of the toxic emotions. It's fine to hang on to those, experience those depleting emotions, but we've got to let them go. Lindy Chamberlain, her story's in my first book, Lindy Chamberlain Creighton, she said, get out of the darkness and into the sunshine as quickly as you can. Just don't get stuck in those toxic, negative, depleting emotions.
Yeah, and that's, of all people, that's certainly a person that had a right to, that in being indignant and angry. But as you said, all that does is create dis-ease anyway by holding on to those emotions.
Yes.
But I'm just thinking that I want to learn more about your books, because it's something very special that you've been doing with your books and the people that you've been speaking to. And tell me about your books, or tell the listeners about your books, because when we spoke the other day, I've gone, oh, this is so important, to this information. And you obviously think it's important. You're publishing books on it. It needs to get out there.
Yes. Well, Janine, I became a resilience coach. And one day I vividly recall one of my clients was suffering from anxiety and depression, and he was pacing up and down and he wouldn't keep still. And he said, how do other people make the pain go away? How do other people find happiness again? And I thought, wow, they're really good questions, because there are plenty of self-help guidebooks, but I think we're programmed to learn from people's true stories. And so when I just sat with those questions and I thought, yeah, fantastic questions, I'd love to explore the answers. And when COVID began and we were locked down and all my clients cancelled, I thought this is a good time to explore the answers to those questions. So I was living on my boat at the time in the Sunshine Coast, and I yeah, wrote my first book. So I just researched the topics that I wanted to cover, which is just a wide range of life experiences, hardships that we suffer. And then I sought people who have lived those experiences, and also people who are able to articulate how they recovered from them. So that is how I wrote my first book, Campfire for the Heart, about 30 Australians. And then my and at that stage, I didn't have a publisher when I wrote my first book, so I took my time. I was under no pressure. It took me 18 months. And then with the second book, I was fortunate enough that Big Sky Publishing published my first book.
Well, that's a lot of kudos, yes.
Yeah. And then very quickly, they asked me to write a second book about women, Campfire for a Woman's Heart. So I had a deadline for that, and I wrote that book in 6 months.
Wow.
to meet the deadline. So So I was under a lot of pressure, and my life was not balanced during that 6 months at all. I didn't exercise, and I just woke up, grabbed my laptop, and worked until the sunset. So,
and that sort of thing is not bad for a short period of time, but it's not how we want to live our lives permanently.
No, it's not very sustainable. So with my third book, I hope I can strike a balance.
And how do you find the people that inspire you that you write about?
Firstly, I write a list of all the life experiences and hardships, traumas and tragedy that I want to cover.
Yes.
And then I, various ways, it could be word of mouth. Sometimes I actually Google the subject. For example, I wanted in Campfire for a Woman's Heart, I really wanted to interview a woman from Ukraine who had moved to Australia. So I just Googled refugee from Ukraine woman. And from that, I met this wonderful woman who now lives in Western Australia. Sometimes it's word of mouth. Sometimes it's just from media. I found some people from Australian Story, like Gail Shan, who was featured on Australian Story quite a bit. Bill O'Connor, who was also in my first book, he was on Landline. He's such a tough old man. He's from a sheep and cattle station in New South Wales, and he lost his leg in a fencing accident, and then. When he was young, and then went on, worked about another 60 odd years running his sheep and cattle station with one leg.
Wow.
Incredible man.
Yeah.
So, there are quite a lot of different ways that I sourced the storytellers, the contributors. Mm. And it actually took longer to find the contributors than it was to actually write or edit their stories.
Now, but how inspired did you feel, though, after speaking to these people and learning about their stories? Was it something they just went, oh, the tragedy of the story or the sadness of it, but then this, my goodness me, it felt enlightened or lighter? Is that how the stories sort of go?
All the stories are told in a hero's journey structure. So every story is told in that same format.
You want to explain that for people who don't know what that is?
Hero's journey is based on Joseph Campbell's map of life experience. So each story starts with, so it's a cycle, starts with their comfort zone, what happened before the event, and then their descent into their heart, into the trauma or tragedy. And how it feels, they do talk about how it feels like in the abyss, in the depths of it. So it's none of the stories are a Pollyanna, it's no Pollyanna lens. There's no, this happened, but I'm okay and I bounce back. There's none of that bouncing back. Every storyteller does describe how difficult it was, but they did rise. No, every storyteller, what they have in common is they didn't give up. They found resilience tools to rise again. So the story is about how they rose, and then it finishes with what their life is like now, and they impart their wisdom about to help their readers. So that's the hero's journey structure.
Mm-hmm.
But gosh, yes, every woman in the second book and every contributor in the first book, I admire greatly. And sometimes I think, you know, I think I know quite a bit about resilience now because I've been, you know, studying and teaching it for years now. But then sometimes I learn from them. Like, for example, the Regina from Ukraine, she told me how she, in Ukraine, she told me about the bombs and how the world fell apart when the Russians were attacking, and the how hellish it was in the bomb shelters with, you know, people panicking in the bomb shelters. And they had two little girls, as a husband and two little girls. And she talked about the fleeing in the car and the fear of running out of petrol before they get to the border, and also running out of chips because her little girls were eating, snacking on potato chips in the back seat of the car, and that was distracting them from all the chaos that was going on outside. So she's been through all of that, and yet she said the hardest part of her life was when she was lonely.
Okay. Not,
yeah, when it was before the war, and dealing with loneliness was the hardest part of her life, which speaks of the importance of being connected to other people.
Yeah.
And we're designed to, we're social beings, and we all need help sometimes, and we all need companionship.
And that's an important factor, but that's, it's interesting, isn't it, that lonely in that particular story, that it was loneliness that shone for her. Well, it didn't shine for her. It was the opposite of that. It was the darkness for her.
Yes.
In that format. How did you get the name Campfire for the Heart?
It's a metaphoric name. Campfire is a place where we have forever we have gathered around to hear stories and pass on wisdom. And who doesn't like sitting around a campfire sharing or listening to stories? It's just in our instinct. So I thought campfire, all these stories are to nourish our body and mind, body and soul. So it was metaphoric. And when I write the stories, I imagine that all the contributors are gathered around a campfire and telling their story and imparting their wisdom as
nice.
We do.
Yeah. As a camper, I can really relate to that.
Right.
Is it a read aloud type of thing that you could? I'm just thinking about me personally now. Okay, it's all about me, Natalie. That you know, if we're way camping and if I had the book there to be able to read aloud to the other people around the campfire with the other with
absolutely
the yeah
it'd be perfect for reading aloud around a campfire or anywhere because the stories are short.
Yeah,
the stories are short, so it'd be ideal to read a story for 5 to 10 minutes and then talk about it and relate it. You know, how have you experienced this, and how would you, if this happened to you, how would you rise again?
Yeah
ideal because it short stories.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I traveling shortly, so I will have to pick up a couple of copies. There's a copy of both of the books. Are they on audio, just as a question?
Not audio, no. They're digital and hard copies.
Yeah.
And they're available through all good books online and bookshops. Big Sky Publishing is probably the good reference point to find where they're available.
That's just for me. I'm just thinking about it, but I'm sure there's people that are listening that are thinking, oh, that sounds like a great idea too. Or is it just me? And so you're talking about, you know, the different keys to resilience, and I've already written down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So then there's 25. So there's quite a few more.
Oh, we touched on 9 already, have we?
Well, I've got gratitude, food, exercise, savoring, self-love, self-care, mastering thoughts, kindness, connection. Is that?
Yep, social connection. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So that, yes, just in conversation. There you go. You don't actually have to list them, but there's the thinking about some of the other virtues or some of the other resilience points that And I mean, 25 is a lot of points for us to have to not have to, but to think about, to go, am I doing this? Am I doing this? Is this, will this help me be more resilient? But I imagine you find that most people that you work with have got a whole lot of points covered, but there's some points that are really missing.
Absolutely. I'm sure that every listener here is resilient, because we're adults and we've already been through a lot of life challenges. And if you think of how you were when you were little, just little Janine, and you now, how much you have grown in wisdom and strength and resilience in over the years. So I'm sure I think it's important actually to acknowledge for everyone to acknowledge that, yes, I have resilience. Well, yes, I am resilient. It is within me. It is within us all. I find it very helpful to have a robust, as one of my main life lessons is to have a robust set of resilience tools that we can consciously draw upon when needed. So when being resilient doesn't make us immune to hardships at all, but when we have a robust bank of tools, we can actually, when something unwanted happens, we can think, what tools do I need to draw upon to manage this?
Mm.
And sometimes, and that's why I actually love the list. So I actually do go through the list. Acceptance is another, accepting what we can't change.
And that has been a big deal over the last 3 years, particularly, is that acceptance of things that are just happening that we may have had control of in the past, but we don't now. And, you know, I was speaking to somebody yesterday and their family is still disconnected from them because of their different beliefs. And so just, and that's hard to just accept that, but that's all that she said I have to do now, is I just have to accept that's what it is.
Yes, yep, and find peace with that rather than wishing for something else and then feeling, you know, agitated and stressed because it's not the reality. The acceptance is another important one. So is detachment. Detachment is, some people misunderstand detachment. Some people think detachment means you don't care. You don't care about a situation, or you don't care about someone or something.
Yeah.
But detachment is still experiencing the emotions of the situation or the issue, but not letting those emotions control you. And I can give you an example. I can give you an example to clarify. I remember I practiced detachment without even realizing that it was detachment. After my major cancer operation, I had a mastectomy, and then what's called a tram flap rebuild, a breast rebuild.
Nice.
Yeah, nice one. And so I was cut, the surgeon, brilliant, female surgeons actually, cut my abdomen from one hip across to the other, so, and replaced, took all that flesh blood vessels from there and placed it in my breast cavity. I mean, incredible.
Not what they can do, isn't it?
Yeah. But consequently, I was left with a scar, quite a major scar from one hip to the other hip. And I remember going into a bather's shop, swimwear shop, and saying that I want high-cut bikinis to cover my scar because I'm just recovering from this cancer. And she said, oh, cancer. She said, breast cancer these days is just like catching a cold. You get a sniffle and then you get over it. And
nice. So detaching from the
that
person's ignorance.
yes. So I practiced detachment there unknowingly. I just paused and thought, you know, that's, she's just doing her, she's just reacting based on her lack of experience or lack of empathy. That's just her. But I'm not going to get caught up in that emotion of it. I'm going to get, you know, offended and upset about it. So that was detachment.
Yeah, that's a strong one, and that's a difficult one to do. When I'm teaching people public speaking, there's 3 D's that I with your audience, and one of them's detachment. You can't. People bring their own baggage into your audience, and if someone falls asleep, maybe, or is not really paying attention.
Right.
I mean, there's tools to engage people, but it might be just that they, and I've had this happen, they've just caught a midnight flight from Perth to Sydney and they're exhausted and fallen asleep in the,
right.
that instead of taking on the emotion of them.
Yes.
Yeah, so detachment's one of the things with speaking as well. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so that's interesting, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of character virtues that help us, can help to strengthen or boost our resilience. I believe that if we look after our character will look after us. And it's so important to work on and improving our character, identifying our weaknesses and strengthening them.
Yes. Yeah. And identify, I mean, I'm sure that most of us, as we're adults, someone along the line has identified our weaknesses for us, and we may need to.
Yes, absolutely.
And figure out whether it's really true or not. That's an important factor. Mm. And whether you're prepared to hear whether that's true or not. I got this wonderful quote the other day, and I'm just going to read it. It's better to adjust your life to accommodate their absence than adjust your boundaries to accommodate their disrespect.
Mm.
And that's one of your, it fits in with a couple of the things that you've said for resilience, is sometimes you just have to, you know, detach from the situation and move on, isn't it?
Yes,
rather than trying to conform and fit to other people's expectations.
I think an example, I think one of the best examples of detachment is was displayed by Lindy Chamberlain Creighton. I asked her, as people who were alive in that time when Lindy was in the news and vilified by the public, vilified by the media, and wrongfully accused of murdering her baby, and in prison she was treated so cruelly in prison. And I asked her, how did you cope with all the vilification and the people's nastiness, the meanness? And she said, I see their nastiness as a ball, and they can throw that ball at me, but I can choose whether to catch it or not. And I chose not to catch it.
Yeah, that's
a good metaphor.
I love that metaphor, and I love the visualization of that metaphor. And I think that was part of Lindy's problem, is she didn't conform to society's standard of how someone should behave. Because the people were making a judgment on how they would respond and behave to something, as opposed to someone like her that obviously had quite a robust resilience, using your words, and being able to, not only be losing her baby, but then being charged for the murder. That was my, on that statement all the way through, I kept saying, but what if she's innocent? You can't imagine how that would feel, that you not only lost the child, but you've also been blamed for the, and that your other children were complicit in it as well.
Yeah.
And realizing that.
She's a very strong and admirable woman.
Yeah, most definitely. Any other people particularly stand out that you can think of that you've interviewed?
Each story to me is special in their own way. Because I love animals. There's one story about animals that melts my heart, and that story is of Kobe Steele, who I'll tell you who she is when I at the end of the story, end of her story. But she had a baby who grew up 25 years old. She was a single mother. And just before her daughter's wedding, she was hit by a truck, and her daughter was killed in Amsterdam. And Kobe was grief-stricken, of course, shocked, grief-stricken, and suffered from depression and agoraphobia for years. And then a good friend of hers said, Kobe, you must come to Borneo with me, and the orangutans will heal you. And she thought that was the most stupid thing she's ever heard. And then her friend kept persisting, And she did go to Borneo and she did go into the jungle with the orangutans. But she said for the first week, she said she loved the course being with the orangutans, but her heart was still closed. She was still holding in that pain. And then she went to a little orphanage, an orangutan orphanage, and she said that the cracks of her heart started to open, and a little infants, orangutan infants playing all around her. And then she could see in a corner a little boy orangutan who was bald and he was suffering from trauma after losing his mother and depressed. And they looked at each other, they had eye contact. And then he came over to Kobe and sat on her lap. And she said, we looked into each other's eyes, but beyond that, we saw each other's souls. And we could see that we both needed
giving me chills.
And we could see that we both needed help. Yeah. And she said that gave her purpose. She went from then on, she thought, I'm going to help this little boy and I'm going to help orangutans. Yeah. And she said the orangutans actually saved her life, which brings me to the point. And another tool for resilience is having a purposefulness.
Yeah.
And that's many women have about that.
Yeah. That's a nice way to say that. Wow, that's very, very moving story, but her way of expressing that.
Yes.
Having a purpose is probably, when this airs, it'll be months after I'm not sure what the result will be, but my brother-in-law is very ill at the moment, but he has been for ages and dealing with it. But he's been running his business. He's had that purpose to do that. And now he's just not in too much pain to even concentrate on focusing. And it's really taken the life out of him.
Right.
Because he's missing that purpose. But
yes.
Yeah, yeah. And it does. It makes a lot of difference to people.
It does. Another woman, Susie Ratcliffe, her sister Joanne Ratcliffe was kidnapped from Adelaide. Joanne Ratcliffe. Never seen again. And so Susie grew up in a household with parents and siblings, but there was a big void in the house because Joanne was gone forever. And Susie found purpose of supporting other families who had lost missing children, missing people. So she founded Leave a Light on Inc. And a charity supports people with missing
people. And I'm trying to think of the family up here that have done so much after their son was taken from the bus stop. The on the Sunshine Coast, the name escapes me.
Yes, I know.
They've done so much. That's been their purpose, and they've had me on a hold on to that. We've covered so much. I'm definitely going to get the books and have a read of them around the campfire. In particular, I'm going to save it up for that. If we had some takeaway points quickly, what would you want people to remember after listening to this?
Firstly, that it's not what happens to you, but how you react to it that matters. So how we have a choice in how we react to it. So I made the mistake after my divorce of hanging on to those toxic negative emotions and it didn't serve me well. Mm. But we can choose happiness. And we can find our pathways to happiness. We just have to know how. And it's a choice. It's a choice.
Yeah.
Secondly, to not get stuck in our abyss, in the depths of our despair. It's quite normal to experience it because we're not meant to be. It's unrealistic to think that we're meant to be happy all the time. That's not realistic. But when unwanted events happen, tragedies, traumas, feel the pain, but don't get stuck in the pain.
Mm.
Find a way to rise again.
Yeah.
And thirdly, my third point would be to remember that you are resilient. Just remember how far you have come so far. And as our late Queen Elizabeth said, no one has a monopoly on wisdom.
I like that. Yeah. And then that's a great point. And you brought that up earlier, that we all have a level of resilience within us because we are here.
Yes.
And and we've survived everything that's come at us so far. So drawing on that. Natalie, how can people get in touch with you and find your books?
Well, my website is quite easy to remember. It's my surname, which is StockdaleWellbeing.com. And information about my books are on there. But my books have been published by Big Sky Publishing. So there's lots of information also on Big Sky Publishing about where to access the books.
And that's Campfire for the Heart and Campfire for the Woman's Heart.
For a woman's heart.
Going to grab both of those. And I know you've got some promotions around the place, which when this goes to air, I think you might have finished doing those. But keep an eye out and just see where Natalie might pop up somewhere and to talk about her books. Is there anything that you want to add before we just wrap up this last minute, Natalie?
No, I think we've covered a lot. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
I think resilience is one of the most important factors that we need to be able to tap into when we've got struggles. I love the idea of the books, and when we chatted quickly the other day, the inspiring stories of the people that you've interviewed really engaged me, and I'm sure it's engaged the listeners here who will then be inspired to go and learn a little bit more about those inspiring people. You know, the word inspired three times in the one sentence, basically.
Thank you, Janine. And what I do love, what I find very satisfying, is hearing people's feedback, because some people contact me and say, thank you for writing the book. This particular story resonated with me for a particular reason. And then I have great pleasure in passing that feedback on to the contributor, onto the storyteller. So that's very validating to the storyteller
That's wonderful. And that does create that circle then, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Well, it gives value and meaning to their story.
Oh, that, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you again, Natalie. It's been fun having the discussion. All of Natalie's contact details will be in the show notes, whether you're watching this on YouTube or listening on your favourite podcast channel. I am Janine Vosper. Thank you for being here as my listener, my watcher, and subscriber to the We Are Women podcast. Remember, if you are thinking that you might need a little bit of assistance along the way, not sure where to go and who might be able to help you, go to JanineVosper.com, book in a strategy call. And if I can't help you, I know lots of other people who have got the skills to be able to do that. Have a fantastic day, week, month, wherever you are around the world. Enjoy. Bye-bye for now.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.